Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of The Working Experience, a very warm open arm audio embrace and a squeeze. This episode is brought to you by my company, One Circle Media. One Circle Media is a hybrid digital agency and media content creator. We create and design apps, websites, videos, social media content, and physical products. We are artists, directors, designers, producers, coders, editors, thinkers, makers, and creators who embrace story and creativity from design, web and app development, animation, docs, features, TV shows, digital and social media content to physical products. For our clients, we create content that builds networks and audiences across multiple platforms. Check out our work at onecircledigital.com and onecirclebrand.com. If you work for a network, studio, brand, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Working Experience.
The Working Experience.
Route 93 North is almost at a standstill. It's a rough one out there this morning. Snow and sleet.
There is no service on
the... Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Yeah, folks. We're going to be a few minutes. We have train traffic ahead of us. We should be moving shortly.
John, we need that report ASAP.
Where are we on that presentation?
Dan, HR wants to see you.
Did you return that email yet?
We have a team meeting at 10.
To stay late, Bob.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
They're moving in a different direction.
And after the meeting, we'll have a breakout session.
Who ate my biscuits?
Where are my hot pockets?
This microwave is disgusting.
Oh, God, what's that smell?
He was dipping his toenails at his desk.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Working Experience Podcast. My guest today is Richard D. Kahlenberg, who is a non-resident scholar at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. He is the author or editor of 18 books, and he has been called the intellectual father of economic integration of the economic integration movement in K-12 schooling, and arguably the nation's chief proponent of class-based affirmative action in higher education admissions. He is also an authority on housing segregation, teachers' unions, charter schools, community colleges, and labor organizing. His latest book is Excluded: How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls We Don't See. Welcome, Richard Kahlenberg.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Matthew.
I believe I heard you on NPR, is that correct? Or it might have been an article I read.
I have been on NPR a number of times, so that's possible.
Okay. And what did kind of catch my eye was the affirmative action idea. Full disclosure, as I said to Mr. Kahlenberg, I am a high school teacher, as our listeners know. So that all, the whole education thing caught my eye as well. But why don't we start with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your education, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. So I grew up, I was born in Washington, D.C., grew up in New Jersey and then Minnesota. My father was a liberal minister. My mother was active in the community, a school board member, and then I went off to college at Harvard, and then Harvard Law School. But probably the pivotal moment for me came in college when I did my thesis on Bobby Kennedy and his 1968 campaign for president. I'm talking about Bobby Kennedy Sr., to be clear.
Right.
To be distinguished from the current candidate. Mm-hmm. And I've got a big, poster in my office of Bobby Kennedy, because that kind of everything that I've written since then goes back to that time in 1968, when Kennedy was a strong advocate for civil rights, had really broad appeal among Black and Hispanic voters, but also managed to appeal to working class white voters, some of whom actually had voted for George Wallace. And so I was fascinated by that political coalition, and he did it in part by emphasizing common issues of concern to all these voters about how they were all given kind of a raw deal in American society. And so everything I've written since then is really goes back to that formative experience back in college.
You know, I just recently read a book called Birchers, which is all about the John Birch Society, and Matthew Dalek wrote, and he was actually on the podcast, and that was a very interesting, it was a fascinating read about, it was George Wallace is mentioned quite a bit in that book, and, you know, their relationship to today and all of that. And so it's interesting you mentioned like Wallace supporters then turning and supporting Bobby Kennedy, and it's fascinating how these different groups, to, I don't know, meld, meet, they diverge and all of that.
That's right. Well, the great civil rights leader, Bayard Rustin, said, civil rights and labor leader, said, you know, the lower middle income white voters are neither liberal nor conservative. They're both. And how they vote is going to depend on how issues are framed. And I'm someone who believes deeply in civil rights and addressing racial inequality. But at the same time, I think we have to speak to people whose experiences are shaped by their economic background and find out what, you know, what can bring these groups together, because the right wing, you know, for generations has been trying to divide working people by race. And sometimes I'm afraid that some of my liberal friends actually kind of unwittingly foster that division with very race specific policies that end up alienating people who could be supportive of social change in the country.
I alluded to it briefly, but what I recall, and I think this was something I read, that your take on affirmative action was somewhat at odds with the people you just described as your liberal colleagues, if you will, who might be on the same end of the political spectrum. But you take a somewhat different tack, which has caused maybe a little bit of a rift. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I've long been a supporter of affirmative action in college admissions based on economic disadvantage. Now, this would, you know, disproportionately benefit Black and Hispanic students because of our terrible history of racial discrimination in this country. But it would also give a break to working class white and Asian students, who I think deserve a leg up given the odds they've had to overcome. And what bothered me about the you know, until recently, the existing system of race-based affirmative action before the Supreme Court struck it down, is that it tended to benefit, the whole system tended to benefit upper middle class and wealthy students of all colors. And so 71% of the students at Harvard who were Black and Hispanic came from the richest one-fifth of the Black and Hispanic populations nationally. And the white and Asian students were even wealthier. You know, so Harvard was majority-minority, which is a beautiful thing, something I support. But it also had 15 times as many rich kids as low-income students. To my mind, we'd be much better off in terms of fairness and in terms of politics if we meaning progressives and liberals, supported affirmative action based on economic disadvantage. And now that the Supreme Court has struck down the use of race, that's exactly where President Biden went. He said, while he disagreed with the decision, he said, we should be looking at adversity that students have overcome. Adversities that they've overcome, and so I think we're on a better path for affirmative action using that method.
So instead of just looking at that one, obviously very superficial by its very nature facet, but as you said, it does lead to, you know, obviously people of minority communities and so forth have experienced more economic disadvantage than their, you know, white counterparts.
That's right. It's precisely because of discrimination that Black and Hispanic students are coming from disproportionately poor families and will disproportionately benefit from a class-based system. But it doesn't cause the same backlash that race-based preferences did. They were deeply unpopular. 74% of Americans oppose the idea of using race in admissions, according to Pew, which is not a right-wing group, the Pew Research Center. So it's I think we're on a better path, a fairer path for affirmative action in the future.
So how do you then take that back? Because I used to teach in the South Bronx, and now I teach in Massachusetts in a suburb. I would describe as somewhat upper class, but you know, it varies. I mean, there's not everybody there. There are a lot of economic challenges there too. But how do you bring that back to like a kid who grows up in a really very challenged, you know, I'll say inner city neighborhood where, you know, the schools are just terribly underfunded? I mean, how do you, you know, I went to Fordham University. It was right across the street from Theodore Roosevelt High School. 5,000 kids in that high school, and I mean, apparently it was challenging. So I guess that's my question. Like, how does a kid who has to go through 4 years of that type of high school even begin to be able to compete, you know, or get the academic foundation they need?
Right. Well, I'd say a couple of things. One is there was a study done by Caroline Huxby at Stanford that found that there are thousands and tens of thousands of low-income students who actually do quite well despite the odds. You know, they're in the top couple of percentiles in terms of SAT scores. So there are students out there, not that many, but enough to fill these selective, provide a meaningful representation of these selective institutions. So that would be number one. But number two, to your point, you know, affirmative action is a band-aid at the end of the process. It's much, much more important to find ways to give, you know, improve our public schools, make sure they're adequately funded. And I've also been a strong advocate of finding ways to give kids of different economic and racial groups a chance to go to school together. So going back to the 1960s, there have been two kind of important social science findings that are repeated over and over again. The first is that the biggest predictor of how well a student will do is the socioeconomic status of the family that she comes from. That's the biggest. That's true in all societies. It's just that's something that we have to think about. And so that is an argument for things like better labor unions who can raise wages so that families aren't so stressed economically, higher minimum wage, those sorts of policies. But then the second biggest predictor of academic achievement is the socioeconomic status of your peers in school. And so we know that low-income students can do really important things, amazing things, if they are given the right educational environment. But now we economically segregate them, for the most part, into separate schools from wealthier students. And that in turn is driven by, you know, the zoning policies that are the subject of my new book that you mentioned, Excluded, because in essence, upper middle class communities, places like Scarsdale, New York, set up these walls. I call them the walls we don't see because they're not visible, but they're walls to be sure. And they will ban multifamily housing. They'll say, you're welcome to come live in Scarsdale so long as you can afford a single family home, sometimes on a minimum lot size of a half an acre. People think that Scarsdale just, is rich because that's, it's a desirable community. You have to pay more. No, it's much more complicated than that. There are rules set up to divide us, zoning rules, and that has a huge impact on education, given that one of the best things we can do for economically disadvantaged students is give them a chance to go to economically mixed schools as opposed to to sticking them in high poverty schools.
I have read this book, and we studied it in school. It's called The Other Wes Moore. And, you know, he worked for Obama and all that. And he wrote about this other guy named Wes Moore who lived like three blocks from him. He ended up doing life in prison. The Wes Moore, the author, has gone on to be quite successful. But, you know, he mentions that school education, particularly higher education, it's not, you can learn all this stuff on YouTube, basically. It's more about social connections, like who you meet, who you know. And, you know, if you meet those people, you know, like there's a Fordham club, there's a Harvard club, it's a lot about, I mean, I shouldn't say you can learn all of it on YouTube, but his point was like that social connection, developing that social intelligence, how to speak to people in that class, that's as important, if not more, than what you're learning out of textbooks.
Absolutely. And Raj Chetty, the economist at Harvard, recently did a study of your Facebook friends. So these are not people's closest friends necessarily, right, but they're connections.
Yeah.
And he found that was a huge predictor of upward mobility. If low income young people have access to networks that include some more socioeconomically advantaged folks, then they're much more likely to go on to be economically successful. And so I agree with the analysis that, I mean, I think what Wes Moore is saying has a lot of research behind it. And he I live in Maryland, so he's my governor now. So I'm glad that he was aware of that research, and hopefully he'll translate that into good public policy in Maryland.
You know, I looked at the top, I think top 20 high schools in Massachusetts, and except for one, they all had the same thing in common. They had about a 12 to 14 student ratio to teacher, as opposed to none of them. One school, I think it was Boston Latin, which is a testing school, had like a 20 to 1. So that's kind of an outlier. And, you know, it occurred to me that a lot of times the elephant is in the room is you need more money to build more schools, to have less students in classes, and oftentimes there's just not really the political will to do that, to actually put that money in.
Yeah. I'll agree in part and disagree a little bit. So I completely agree that the resources are essential to making sure that the schools work well. And there's, you know, very powerful research from Tennessee and elsewhere that suggests reduced class size, particularly in the early grades, has a big impact on academic achievement. I mean, any teacher would know this anyway, but anyway, the research bears it out. So I agree with that. The part where I'll complicate things a little bit is that in addition to the reduced class size, it does come back to those issues, that issue that we were talking about earlier, peers. And I'm thinking in particular of a study in Montgomery County, Maryland, so right outside of Washington, D.C., where there were two interventions. One was the school board spent $2,000 extra per pupil in the poorer schools, the higher poverty schools. And one of the things they spent money on was reduced class size. So that was a good investment. And it had a positive effect on academic achievement of students. But at the same time, the housing authority implemented a plan where when a builder develops a certain number of units, he or she has to set aside a percentage for low-income families. And a researcher at the RAND Corporation was able to study who did better. All the students in her sample were in public housing, but some were in these units in middle-class neighborhoods where the builder had to set aside some of the units. And they're actually spending $2,000 less per pupil. And then some were in the higher poverty regions where you spent $2,000 more. And money matters in education, but it turned out that the peers mattered more. And ironically, that the intervention of the housing authority had a bigger impact on academic achievement than the intervention of the school board. So to be clear, spending matters, what the school board does matters, but also housing policy is going to matter a lot for the how well students do in life.
And there's also the issues of what's going on at home, nutrition, crime in the neighborhoods. And so, like, I would love to boil it down to one solution, smaller class sizes, but as usual, as you say, it's more complicated. I would love to get into the book, because it does it lends to all that we're talking about. So how, and I'll just repeat the title because it would be great to unpack this. Excluded: How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls We Don't See. I'm wondering how you, well, first of all, if you want to kind of unpack that title for us, and then I'm always interested in process. So, like, how you actually went out and did the research for the book.
Yep. Okay, great. Well, so the title refers to, the walls we don't see are these zoning laws, exclusionary zoning laws that prohibit, by government fiat, the building of more affordable types of market housing. I'm not even talking about government subsidized housing. I'm talking about, in communities like Scarsdale, if a developer said, I can make more money if I build a duplex or a triplex on this plot of land rather than a single family home, because I can spread the costs over several units, two or three units, the government prohibits that. It's not allowed by the zoning law. And we see that all the time. There are more subtle things that they do. So they'll say, yes, you can have multifamily housing in this community, but only if it uses this expensive brick siding as opposed to, a vinyl siding. So they'll put in standards that essentially are about excluding those of low income and working class backgrounds. And part of the idea is that it's better in kind of very crass terms for the wealthy community to exclude, because the low income and working class families are going to require more social services on average than a wealthier family. And they won't necessarily be paying the same high taxes. And so that's part, it's called fiscal zoning. The concept is, if you're lucky enough to have made it in American society, then we have the right to use the government as a tool to exclude people who are less fortunate. I find that a really troubling concept. I'd rather us think of all the kids as being our kids, in a broad sense, as opposed to just the kids who are of the same socioeconomic grouping. So that's part of what's going on. Part of it is snobbery. And here, I'm concerned that, one of the findings in the book was that there's actually more exclusionary zoning in liberal areas, which is politically liberal areas, which is confusing, because if you think, who supports the wall, building a wall to exclude people from Mexico, immigrants, it tends to be Republicans and conservatives. And yet, when it comes to zoning, it is, liberals who live in the most exclusionary areas. And I think there is a blind spot to this issue of class among some of my liberal friends, so that, they would be the first to say, as they should, it's a completely wrong to exclude people based on race. But there are some social science findings that suggest that more educated people who today are more politically liberal on average have higher levels of bias towards the less educated. So upper middle class white people have less bias towards black people, but more bias towards those with less education of any race. And I think that's part of what's going on with exclusionary zoning as well. The idea that, well, we, you know, there's certain folks who are, you know, in the language of Hillary Clinton, deplorable, and we don't want them in our community. And on one level, I understand exactly what she was saying. Some of the stuff, the hateful stuff that was said at Trump rallies is itself deplorable. But to write off a whole group of working class people as deplorables is quite another matter. And I think that's part of what's going on with zoning. In terms of my process, I've written a number of books, and I'll come across a social science finding that strikes me as interesting and not something that's been acted upon by public policymakers. And then I try to figure out ways to act upon it. And so, for example, you know, I wrote a book on integrating schools by socioeconomic status based on this research that your peers matter. And but then I spend a lot of time thinking about, well, how on earth are you going to make this politically possible? And in that case, you know, it's through the use of magnet schools and some sort of something that you're going to attract middle class families into economically mixed schools. Because if you just try to force it, it's not going to happen. And in the case of zoning, I think the politically viable path is to emphasize the ways in which this bias is really class-based, because we saw that there was zoning reform in places like California and Oregon, and there was political support from Republicans who represented rural, white, working-class voters, and Democrats who represented Black and Hispanic urban voters. And basically, they came together to say it's wrong for the wealthy, predominantly white suburbs to exclude everyone else. And it brought together an alliance of people who felt looked down upon because of their race, and people who looked down upon because they have less education. And we saw some social change there. So that to me has been an exciting development in the housing arena.
Is there a way that, just to use the Scarsdale example, is there a way that you can make it, I guess attractive is the only word I can put to it, to the people of Scarsdale who are already there and live in a $1.2 million home and all that? Like, is there a way to say, hey, look, this is going to benefit you too?
Yeah, I think there are ways to talk about that. And there is a lot of research to suggest that the benefits of economic and racial integration in schooling goes in all directions. That is, upper middle class white kids benefit when they are in classrooms with people who have different life experiences because of their race or because of their economic status. And that right now, when Scarsdale has 0% low income students and very few Black and Hispanic students, the kids are missing out. Scarsdale kids are missing out on something. You know, they're trying to be prepared for the life in the 21st century, and they're not being exposed to the realities increasingly diverse society. And so I think one can make the case that this would be good for the kids of Scarsdale to have to relax the strict zoning rules to allow students from different backgrounds to have a chance to participate in the public schools. And then more broadly, I think there's always been an argument against wealthier people just trying to seal themselves off, because ultimately it arouses lots of resentment. And so you're going to get a backlash from working people, and you'd rather be something productive. I think a large part of Donald Trump's success was that that there were people who were fed up and just wanted to shake up the system. Now, I personally can't fathom the idea of ever having voted for Donald Trump. I think he said so many hateful things that it's not something I can understand fully. But at the same time, I understand that there is frustration with the way the system works. The author George Packer talks about, you know, working class people who look at upper middle class white communities and they say, the kids all go to school together, then they all go off to certain colleges together, and then they move back to those communities and they all know each other in certain social networks, and there's no way to break into that. And that yields frustration. And so at the end of the day, if we want to kind of keep a democratic capitalist system, which I think we should, then we need to address some of these festering resentments and use that for productive social change rather than, you know, potentially authoritarian inroads into American society.
You know, I remember really cringing when Hillary Clinton said that about the deplorables. And I am in your boat. I cannot fathom voting for someone like Donald Trump or anybody of that stripe. But I really cringed because I thought, man, you're playing right into his hands saying that, because he was able to use that. And, you know, I sort of thought, do you really think that? I mean, do you really think? Because it seemed to me to ignore what I had heard from people who did vote for Donald Trump or were planning to, swallowing a bitter pill, who seemed like genuinely good people. And they were very anguished. They were very afraid. They could not pay their mortgages, their rents. They were very afraid of the future. And to call them that and to not, you know, if you're a liberal, you're supposed to be empathetic with everyone, not just other liberals, you know, but to me.
And she said it at fundraisers between very, very, you know, a couple of them. I mean, it wasn't just once, she said. She said it a number of times. At before very, very wealthy audiences, and they were kind of laughing at this group of working class people. And I think it was, I mean, clearly it did backfire.
Yeah.
But we still see it today. There was a Saturday Night Live skit not long ago after the Virginia gubernatorial election when Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, won. And the joke supposedly was, you know, what was the number one issue for the voters? Well, it was education. And who were those voters? People who didn't go to college. And there was a lot of laughter from the studio audience. And I just thought it was appalling, the idea that because someone hadn't gone to college, therefore they don't care about education.
Right.
To make that connection. And yet that kind of sneering at people with less education is I think unfortunately too common, and particularly on, you know, kind of my side of the political aisle, I think it's a real issue we have to deal with.
Yeah, you know, and when you said it, the isolation of the wealthy stirs resentment, it also seems to stir resentment in the wealthy in a weird way. They become very paranoid, very like there's been studies done, like the more you surround yourself with security and the more you isolate yourself, the more you feel like the hordes are out there and they're coming to get you. And it can turn a rather liberal person into a very fearful conservative person. So the more these people, you know, isolate and only talk to each other, and, you know, I feel very fortunate having taught in the Bronx for about 13 years because I really saw the other side of it.
Right.
And, you know, the neighborhood was what it was, but I never felt scared or fearful for myself or anything like that. And I think, you know, I just, the more you isolate yourself and the more you never speak to anybody else who doesn't look like you or believe, you know, they become monsters. And you can see why. Well, you use the term NIMBYism, which is a term I hadn't heard in a while. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Yes. So NIMBY stands for not in my backyard. Mm. And it's a common phenomenon in American society that people say, of course we need more housing. There's a housing shortage. Housing's too expensive. The way to make it less expensive is to increase the supply. And yet they don't want it anywhere near them.
Right.
It's a very, very disturbing concept. Fortunately, there's now a new group. They call themselves YIMBYs. Yes, in my backyard. So these are people who want social change. And there was a great, there's a terrific group in Minneapolis called Neighbors for More Neighbors, which I thought was a really good name for a group. And they said, we ought to open up our neighborhoods so that young people, people who may have been down on their luck, have a chance to have housing as well. And so Minneapolis, beat the NIMBYs, not in my backyard folks, and decided to eliminate the single family exclusive zoning, which had been in place in about 75% of Minneapolis's land area. 75% was single family only, and they changed that. And so now they've legalized duplexes and triplexes so that different types of housing can be available throughout the community. And it doesn't change overnight. It's not as if everyone goes out and converts their single family home to a two or three family home. But there are a lot of people who now have, you know, backyard apartments that they rent out or garage apartments, technically called accessory dwelling units. And that gives a chance to someone who couldn't afford to live in the neighborhood to have that opportunity to be near good jobs or good schools.
So just to get back to your book itself, like when you sit down to write this book, this came out in 2023. When you sit down to write it, what are you doing? Are you looking at research? Are you interviewing people? Or are you looking at histories? Like, how do you exactly go about the research for it or the study for it?
Well, I would say all of the above. So I think it makes sense to start with the history, mm-hmm. because you want to know how did zoning come about? And there's a dark history because it started as racial zoning, where people just were trying to quarantine Black people, essentially. So look at the history. That's important to do. It's important to look at the social science research on what's the effect of zoning. And there's kind of a political consensus, or a social science consensus, I should say, that this is bad public policy. Conservative economists say this is distorting the market. Liberal economists agree. So look at the social science. But then importantly, you have to go out and talk to people as well. And so in the book, I have a lot of interviews, particularly with low-wage mothers who I think are quite sympathetic. If you're a middle-class reader and you might have certain stereotypes about low-income people, I hope that in reading the book, you'll meet a number of mothers who have the same values. They want the same thing that every mother wants. They wanted better schools for their kids. They wanted a safe neighborhood. I interviewed one mother, Kiara Cornelius, who said, she had to drive her kids to her mother's house, which is only a couple blocks away, because it was so unsafe for her to walk them. So she wanted out of that neighborhood. But what was keeping her out of the more, the safer neighborhoods was the limitations on the housing supply there. She couldn't afford a single family home. So, and she, she had one kid who was, is academically gifted. She really, really wanted a good school for him. And so she found a program that gave her basically an ability to catapult over these walls that have been built by exclusionary communities. But it would be much better if we just brought those walls down itself. And so I learned a lot from interviewing people. And I also interviewed a lot of people in Minneapolis and California and other places where, you know, they were able to successfully make change. How did you do it? What sort of political coalitions did you put together? So that's the process, is all of those things that you mentioned.
So when you're interviewing like a low-income single mother, how are you finding her? How are you getting in touch with her?
Oh, that's a great question, because that is actually the most challenging,
I would imagine,
part of the research. And so I had a colleague, Michelle Burris, who was very helpful in this process. And she worked very hard to find people who could talk about the challenges they faced and illustrate the problem. And we would often go to an established organization in the community that helps people who are having housing challenges, talk to them and see whether they have someone to suggest. And then we talk with them and, you know, we'd ask, do you have any friends who are in a similar situation? And, you know, so that's kind of the process. But it's very easy to sit at your computer and find the empirical research that explains the ways in which the world works at a macro level. Much, much harder to identify good people to talk to about that will help readers understand the problem at a more granular level. And all the research shows, and Republicans were onto this much earlier than Democrats, that it's the storytelling that influences people. Their eyes glaze over with the statistics, but you tell them some powerful stories and that's what can move the needle. Ronald Reagan was the master of
master.
That.
Yeah. Well, you know, the reason I ask is because I see on your bookshelf back there, I think that's the Lyndon Johnson book.
Yes.
One of I love those books. And I read The Power Broker, and it really struck me how Robert Caro would go into those neighborhoods. He'd climb up these very dangerous buildings. He describes like climbing up five flights of stairs, and there's this widow living there, and it's just horrible conditions, and sitting with her and talking. And like, he is so good at that, like sitting down, talking with somebody. When he talked to Lady Bird Johnson, Lyndon Johnson's brother. Mm-hmm. And that's where you just get, those stories that he goes on and on in the first book about what it took for a woman to bake an apple pie before electricity. And it's riveting. It's absolutely riveting.
Yes.
And everybody can identify with that, like how hard it might be to do something like that without electricity. And that is just fantastic.
Yes. Well, he sets the standard.
Yeah.
Standard in that respect, and he sets the standard in terms of the archival research too. You know, he has this phrase, "Turn every page."
Turn every page. Yes, yeah.
That's tough to do, but I think he's definitely is a model for all of us to aspire to. I wrote a biography of Albert Shanker, the teacher union leader in New York City, and I definitely wanted to go and did go to, you know, his childhood home to get a sense of that mm-hmm. where he grew up. I mean, there's nothing short of going to a place and visiting and seeing what it's like, as opposed to simply simply doing that research on the web.
It seems to put there's such a lack of context these days, like putting people into context, like seeing where they grew up, what they deal with every day. And, you know, we just seem to about Trump supporters. Like, I don't walk in someone's shoes who is worried every month about making rent. I don't know how that is. So, and, you know, we don't have putting people in context. I don't think you can understand them any other way than to that.
That's right. Yes. And the other one who really did a great job with that was Matthew Desmond, who wrote a book called Evicted. And he spent several years living with with low-income people of all races. So there were white people in trailer parks, black people in inner cities, and spending time with them. And he was able to tell a very nuanced picture. And again, that's kind of it's something that I think every writer aspires to. We don't all meet those levels of Caro and Desmond, but that's what we all should be trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been great. I just want to wrap it up with, what do you find most rewarding about your work?
Well, I guess I would say there have been cases where, I've spoken to an audience about an issue, and I'll have someone come up after me afterwards and tell me how their lives have been impacted by the work that I've been trying to do. And so, for example, on the socioeconomic school integration idea, when I started, there were two communities that took steps to integrate using income as one of the bases. And today there are 171. And there were places where, instances when I've given talks and someone will come up and say, I went to one of those schools that the community economically integrated, and it made a big difference in my life. I met all sorts of people who I wouldn't have otherwise, and I'm a better person. I have been able to achieve more in life because of that public policy intervention. And writing isn't that easy, and so when you're slogging away at it, it's those moments that you have to reach back to remember and feel like it's all worth doing.
That's made an impact.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Richard Kallenberg. The book is, I'm going to go back up to the title here because I do love the title. The book is Excluded: How Snob Zoning, NIMBYism, and Class Bias Build the Walls We Don't See. Thank you very much for doing this. And it was great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Matt. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of The Working Experience. We'd like to thank our sponsors, One Circle Media. If you work for a studio, network, startup, or corporation and are looking for a partner to create media that will build, engage, and entertain your audience, reach out to me at john@onecirclemedia.com. I would love to hear from you. And that's it. The end. The sweet end. Until our next audio encounter.